Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, that feels so good. My home group is the Loop Group in Palm City, Florida, and some of my people are here. So I'm so grateful to be here. I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, the one thing I always love to say when I share with a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is how much I love AA. AA has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams, and I don't use that as a cliche. It has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous broken like most of us, desperate, scared, fearful, angry, resentful, a lot of other stuff too. And you guys gave me back a life. You gave me dignity, self-respect, intelligence, faith, hope, charity, all of those things you gave me. And I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I had a couple of vodkas before I went, because you can't smell vodka on my breath. And I found out later that's a lie. I walked out of that first meeting. I can't tell you what I heard. I can't tell you what I got out of that first meeting. I can tell you who was standing at the coffee pot. I can tell you who I sat across from. I sat across from Harry H., who has probably 12-step more people in South Florida than anyone ever will. And I walked away from that meeting with one thing, and that was hope. You know, I really believe that at that point that you guys had the answer to my problems, that if I just got what you guys had, I had a chance. And our topic today is seeds of faith, which, by the way, I struggled with because I couldn't quite grasp around that. But a friend of mine said, hope is faith without evidence. And I walked away from that first meeting with hope. I didn't have any faith. I was an agnostic. I was angry at God. I was upset. I was frustrated. But I can tell you that about a year before I went to that first meeting, maybe a year and a half before I went to that first meeting, I had gotten down on my knees and I had said, please, God, help me. And I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in a higher power. I had no higher power. I'd grown up very Catholic. I went to a lot of Catholic school. And I had a loving God. I believed in God, but I didn't have this loving faith in God. And I was scared. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no God. But one night, I did get down on my knees. I can tell you where I was. I can tell you how I felt. I can tell you the temperature outdoors. And I said, God, please help me. And I can tell you that it was right after that that God put the seeds of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. God put people in my life that brought me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My boss hired a woman who proudly wore a circle and triangle around her neck. And she shared that she was a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ran a restaurant. She'd bring these people by, and they would they didn't buy any booze, and they drank Diet Coke by the gallon and coffee by the cup, and they laughed and they smoked cigarettes indoors, and for you smokers, and when you could smoke indoors, and they just had joy in their lives, and I go, well, they're not, and she go, oh yeah, they are. And I go, really? The really pretty one? Yeah, she's been sober. She's been sober 5-6 years. I go, well, she wouldn't be interested in me. So God put Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And let me tell you why I was so desperate and alone and fearful and scared. First of all, I'd been that way pretty much my entire life, because if you're an alcoholic like I am, I grew up feeling different. I grew up with fear. I grew up scared. I grew up not feeling a part of. I also felt at the same time that I was better than you, smarter than you, not necessarily better looking than you, but nonetheless, I always had that conflict. But in 1983, I was driving my car home from a bar one night, and it was late. It was 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning, or Sunday evening, Monday morning. And I ran my car up under a semi-truck. And that night, I ripped off half of my head. I fractured my hip. I totaled the car. But the part of my story that's still difficult to tell you is that the girl in my car died that night. My blood alcohol level was 0.22. and I was later convicted of DUI manslaughter. That's why I was so scared. That's why I finally got on my knees and said, God, please help me. And that's when Alcoholics Anonymous was introduced to me. You know, it was a year or so later after the accident. I was facing criminal charges. I was scared to death. I had my suicide plan in place because I did not think I would make a very good husband in a Florida state penitentiary. I was scared to death. And what ended up happening is God put in my friend Bill and my friend Marilyn, who both guided me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was eventually convicted by a judge who didn't have to put me in prison, and for that I'm always going to be grateful. The family of the girl who died in my car asked the judge not to put me in jail. And later on in my sobriety, they offered me their forgiveness, which I don't believe would have happened if it wasn't for the people in these rooms, if it wasn't for the program, the steps, the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you guys gave me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And what happened is once you planted that seed of hope, I'm still trying to tie in that seeds of faith thing, but once you guys gave me that seed of hope, that little bit of belief, that fear, that desperation, that anger and resentment that was inside me, that you guys could help me, I ended up going to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I walked out of that meeting with hope. And a little bit later, I checked into what I thought was a 30-day rehab, but it said long-term psychiatric hospital on the door. I suggested I was in the wrong place. They suggested I wasn't. But that began my sobriety date, which was February 26th of 1985, and I haven't had to pick up a drink since. How am I doing, Gary?
You're doing good.
Okay. By the way, Gary wears a Stanley Cup ring, which is pretty impressive. I'm sorry. I had to throw that out. I'm sure there's some hacky fans out there somewhere. We don't know who's in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's amazing the people I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have friends sitting in the front row of here that I met in Spain, and they're from England, and they're at the International Conference. Is this a great and glorious program or what? That's better than any church I've ever been to. So you guys set up the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys brought me in. And when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had gotten out of a psychiatric hospital. I moved back to Palm Beach County with a year of sobriety, and I really thought y'all would greet me and be happy to have me back, and you guys ignored me pretty much. Didn't help that I sat in the back of the room and waited for you to come to me. Went until someone said, hey, John, why don't you reach your hand out, walk up and introduce yourself to someone. Maybe you'll make a friend. And I can tell you that I've made millions of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I look around this room today, and I'm looking over at Linda over there, who was sitting, was a member of my first home group 30 years ago. You know, I looked up to her because she had more time than I did. Would you have a year more? God is good. And the friends that I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. But you guys then introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I often have said that I think I did the second step first, because when I hit my knees and I asked God for help, God put you in my life. But then when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I took the first step. I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was completely unmanageable. And then God set it up that I would find this faith and a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. And I didn't know I was going to get that gift. I didn't know that's what you were going to give me. When I was several years sober, I had a couple of sponsors that had fired me and some other things. But I had some sponsors that moved out of town, and I was desperate for a new sponsor. And I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been with my brother, who was having a beer with a lime in it. And I don't know about some of you, but I've never had a beer with a lime in it, and it got really popular. And I was sitting there looking at that beer with that lime in it, thinking, well, maybe I could just have one. And I realized, oh, my God, you're in trouble. You know, you can't just use the group as your sponsor. You can't have multiple sponsors. I mean, because my mind is just needs more help than that. So I walked into this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were two men sitting at the coffee pot. One was Giff, and one was Harry. And Harry had sat across from me from my first AA meeting, and Harry was a god to me. And Giff was his sponsor, so Giff was Harry's god to me. And I said to those two men, I really need a sponsor. And I thought that they would appoint me to some lowly sponsor of theirs to take over this poor soul. And a coin went up in the air, I say, and Giff lost. And he became my sponsor. And what's really beautiful is that Giff said, John, here's what I need you to do. I need you to read these books. And it was obviously the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our big book, the first 164 pages, which I had read. And the 12 and 12, which we went through. And I always had a lot of problems with the 12 and 12 because I didn't get it. But that's beside the point. But then he gave me two other books. One was As a Man Thinketh, and the other was Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. And Bill and Bob read those books, and those books were important to the early founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And As a Man Thinketh, and really Emmett Fox's book, changed my perception of God. It gave me a God of my understanding. Reading those books and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to create or believe in the God of my understanding, a loving, gentle, kind God who wants me to be happy, joyous, and free, a God who wants all of us to be happy, joyous, and free, a God who doesn't want me to pick up a drink one day at a time, a God who wants me to share openly my experience, strength, and hope with the help that someone in some room of Alcoholics Anonymous or someone in some part of my life will hear something I've said through him to you that will help you not pick up one drink one day at a time. And that's all I got. That's what you guys gave me. And so Giff took me through the steps, and when I was about 4 years sober, I had to go to a meeting, and it was a trial, and I was meeting with the family of the girl who died in my car. And the first day I was in this trial, I sat next to her father, and her brothers and sisters were in the back of the courtroom with her mother. And I knew these people would hate me for the rest of life because I took the life of their daughter and their sister. And when the trial was about halfway over, I'd gotten off a witness stand, and I turned to her father, and he says, how are you doing? And I said, I've been better. He says, we all have, but it'll be over soon. And he said it like a man would say it to another man. He didn't say it with hate and venom. He said it kindly. And this was a man who was pretty tough. He was an executive on the weekdays, and he was an NFL referee on the weekends. Not quite as tough as the hockey league, but still. And he said, John, it'll be over soon. And when the trial was over, I was able to go up to the family of the girl who died in my car. And through the grace of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, they had found out and they knew what I had been doing. They knew that I was sober. They knew I wasn't still drinking and driving. They knew I wasn't leading the life that I had once led. And they said, John, we want you to know that you've been forgiven. And you go home and get on with your life. Get married, have a family, and start over. And I know that I wouldn't have gotten that if it wasn't for a loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys took me through all of life's challenges. And every time, you guys gave me this God of my understanding. And so it was the seed planted by this in that first meeting that gave me hope that led me to faith. That's how I'm trying to tie this topic in. I thought a lot about it. But what I also thought about was last night, and I don't want to go over time. I usually speak for an hour, and I didn't really think that was fair to the other guys. So last night, as I was thinking about this topic, wrestling with this topic, Chet P., who chaired the meeting last night. And Chet's a friend of mine. And let me tell you one quick story. The judge who sentenced me, I was sentenced in Florida in 1984. And in January 1985, minimum mandatory sentencing went into effect. And in 1984, November of 1984, the judge could make his own decision. And the judge listened to the family of the victim, and the judge listened to my pleas, and the judge didn't put me in the Florida penitentiary system. And for that, I'm forever grateful, because I had a suicide plan mapped out. And I was playing golf at Jekyll Island. Clancy was speaking, by the way. And when I spoke in Toronto, by the way, Clancy was speaking at the same time also. And I do have a resentment with Clancy. But I was in Jekyll Island, and I was in a golf cart, and I met this guy, Chet P., who was the chairman of last night's meeting, and I started talking to Chet, and Chet knew the judge that sentenced me. Chet had worked for the judge that sentenced me. And I said, Chet, I should write this guy a letter and tell him, you know, that I'm doing okay, and that he made the right decision. And Chet said, yeah, you really should. So about a year later, I'm at Jekyll Island, and Chet says, hey, how you doing? I said, hey, you know, I really should write that letter. And Chet says, yeah, you probably should. About a year later, I see Chet at the meeting. I said, hey, Chet. He goes, hey, Ed. I said, I really should write that letter. And Chet goes, yeah, you really should. I'm an alcoholic. I procrastinate from time to time. And I did write the letter. And not only did I write the letter, I sent the letter to the judge. And the judge received the letter. And the judge wrote me back a 2-page handwritten letter. And he said, John, thank you for sending me that letter. He said, I remember your case very well. He said, it was one of the last times I was able to make my own decision. He says, and thank you for sending me that and letting me know that I had made the right decision. And again, I couldn't have done that if it wasn't for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't for people like Chet. But I wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't become the human being I always wanted to be. If I hadn't become the sober man that y'all gave, that you guys allowed me to be. You guys taught me how to live in ease and comfort. What I'm going to tie it up with and try to finish on time. Getting there, aren't I? I'm a clock watcher. Oh, jeez, I got 3 more minutes. yes. Sarah's going, take your time. But when Chet was speaking last night, he talked about Ebbe, Thatcher, and Bill Wilson. And it was Ebbe Thatcher that planted the seeds of hope in Bill Wilson's mind and gave Bill Wilson the idea that he could have his own concept of God. And it was Ebbe Thatcher who planted that seed in Bill Wilson's mind that if you go out and help another alcoholic, you might be able to stay sober yourself. And so with that little bit of idea and that seed that was planted in Bill's mind, he found Dr. Bob. And you know, I heard that last night, and I had to share that, because it seemed to me that the seeds of faith took Bill to Bob and gave all of us this gift, this joyful gift of sobriety that we will be graced with for as long as we live if we just don't pick up one drink one day at a time. Thank you.
You were a minute and a half short. You shortchanged these people. I got a stopwatch here, eh? I didn't know how to use a cell phone 5 years ago, and now using the stopwatch, crazy. He blew my identity. I did play for the Montreal Canadiens 1964-65. And then I was traded to the Rangers to New York. And then I got traded back to Montreal. The dreaded year that the Toronto Maple Leafs last won the Stanley Cup, so I'm still don't like the Toronto Maple Leafs. And then the first year of expansion, I went to Philadelphia. I was with the Flyers for 4 years. And then I went to Boston here. So I had my bags packed lots. I was with the Bruins and then back to New York in the World Hockey. But through all that, as a professional athlete, we drank a lot. And it caught up to me, and I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. End of story. Let's get on with the program.
By the way, I wanted to ask if I could do a selfie, but I decided that was wrong.
Actually, when I was in New York in the World Hockey, I lived in West Orange, New Jersey, for 2 years. And Sarah is from New Jersey, our next speaker, and we're really looking forward to hearing her.
Wow. My name's Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic. If I can get through this. I am just so humbled to be here. Oh my God. I went to my very first meeting on Friday, February 13th, 1981. I was 13 years old. And I haven't stopped coming since. That's not to say I've been sober since then. I was brought to my very first meeting by my father, and I had probably only been drinking for maybe, about a year. And it's funny, I was just reading something yesterday because I was trying so much not to think about this topic. I was like, if I think, I'm going to try and plan and it's all going to come out wrong and I just need to speak through God, you know, let God speak through me. I can't, anytime I try and plan it, it's all wrong. So growing up, I had all those things, all those isms, all those less than, all of that. My family was extremely dysfunctional. From the earliest, even before my very first drink, I remember wanting to not be here. I just wanted to be dead from day one. I don't remember ever being happy as a child. And I was reading as I was preparing, and I saw, it was like kind of like a blog. I was reading about, trying to read about the mustard seed and that kind of thing, you know, seeds, tying it in. And, but this person refers to character defects as character defenses. And I think that's a lot of what I had, you know, it was my defense. I mean, I used to think I wasn't going to live to be 15. And that was cool. I was happy with that. That was like fine. I'm 47 now. you know, so I'm glad it didn't turn out that way. I'm glad I had those defenses. I'm also glad that I did have my last drink when I was 16. My sobriety date is December 10th, 1984. And my home group is Hillsboro, Haven of Hope. I know I got some of them here. And thank you. But that's not for me. That applause is for you, because you people raised me. My family is still completely dysfunctional. You're my family. You're who comes to my house for Thanksgiving. My husband is in these rooms. There's chairs here possibly for my children in these rooms. But where faith comes in for me, that's, you know, John talked about hope. And that's where it is, you know. I came in when I was 13, and I saw the hope in here. You know, I saw the love. I saw the laughter. For the first many years, it was a lot of just fellowship for me. I got to be honest with you. There wasn't a lot of step work. There wasn't a lot of, you know, but I needed that. You know, when you're that young, the concept of God as a child, it wasn't something I even thought about. You know, it's like, that's just not what it's not cool. You just don't think about it. You know, I was very isolated. I was very alone. When I started drinking, I wasn't at a keg party. I've never been to a keg party. I've never played quarters. I was alone. I was an isolated person. My first drink, I stole alcohol from my dad. I held it up to the light, and I said, here's to you, Dad. I'm going to be an alcoholic just like you, and you see how it feels. And from that day, I drank every day. It wasn't, you know, when he started making, because he came in and then dragged me to a meeting, and my very first meeting, like I said, it was in 81. It was in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Anybody? No? Okay. Sunday night meeting, and or was it Friday night? Doesn't matter. And I was, you know, 13. There were no young people back then. And the next youngest, I think my first sponsor was 27, and that's young, but when you're 13, it's old, you know? I mean, it's funny. I went to one of the young people's meetings yesterday, and I'm like, I'm old now. Like, I walk in there, and I'm like, yeah, I'm one of you, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm old. Lot of dye covering the gray, you know. But the faith thing, you know, I kept coming. That was the thing. I kept coming here. And, yeah, I was falling. I was sharing with somebody about a clubhouse I used to go to, and I used to fall off the chair there. But nobody said, Sarah, don't come. You know, I used to raise my hand in meetings and say, I've got a lot of drugs at home. Do you think I should throw them out? I don't recall saying these things. I think I said them in blackouts. You know, nobody said, you're crazy, get out of here. You know, you all loved me when I couldn't love myself. And I kept coming. At one point, I put together 30 days. I was chasing a guy. he was 19, I was 13. Nice. During that 30 days of clean time, I saw it. I really saw it. But unfortunately, I was comparing and not identifying. And when people said, you spilled more than I drank, I kind of said, yeah. You know, I mean, yeah, I spilled more than you. You know, I used that. I wasn't ready. I was comparing. I didn't lose my house, job, car, family, all that stuff. I didn't lose anything because I didn't have anything. And somebody actually said it, that they didn't get their life back. They got a life. And that was me, you know. I had been in the rooms. I'd been in. I don't want to do the whole story. But, you know, it's just life was pretty awful, you know. I didn't have car crashes. I was too young to drive. Basically, my bottom that I was comparing, all these things, I just wanted to die. That's what I wanted. You know, and my faith, there was none. God was something over there for you people. I'm just going to check this because I don't need it. Hot flashes, you know? They come with nerves. But anyway, you know, God was for everybody else, and God was just, it just wasn't relevant. You know, religion was just a ritual. It didn't mean anything. But when I started coming around and when I had that last drink, and it wasn't a big event, my last drink. It was another relapse, whatever, and I just was done. I was just done. I just didn't want to feel ashamed anymore. My life started changing in ways that were very, it was very slow and it was very gradual, and I still didn't have that faith. I went through the motions. I was a people pleaser. People said, kneel, I kneeled. Fake it till you make it. I faked it a really, really, really long time. But I kept coming. And I moved to New Jersey from Pennsylvania, and I was given a dose of humility. I found myself, what I had planned, didn't work out. I found myself living on my sponsor's couch. And I found myself very dramatic. I'm real big on theatrics. I'm driving in my car, and I'm crying, and Sea of Love is on the radio, you know. And I started thinking, this is my spiritual awakening. In my home group people, you've heard it already. It's tough. Hear it again. And this song came on, and I was just thinking to myself, oh, my God, why is this happening to me? I was basically homeless. I was 19 years old, and I was in New Jersey. I knew a few people. And when I moved to New Jersey, I was very, very afraid. I was not outgoing. I did not speak. This was me. This was me. And then eventually I shaved it all off, and I was known as punk rock, but that's another story. But anyway, I was driving in my car wondering, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? And suddenly, I don't know if it was divine. It wasn't a flash of light, but it was just something came over me when I realized it wasn't happening to me. It was happening for me. And no matter what happened in my life, I was not going to shrivel up and die. And when I was going to get to the other side of this, I was going to be a more beautiful person. And that was just a revelation for me, and I've hung on to that ever since. I've had a lot of stuff happen because life happens. Most of it is rewards. You know, the problems I have today are privilege problems. I mean, that was a while ago. And you people have given me all the tools. You are my family. You are my life. I don't know. You know, I don't remember if it was before or after that spiritual awakening, but I remember sitting, I lived on this farm, and I remember sitting out in it's like a dirt yard thing that we used to park on. And I remember sitting there, and I was talking to a woman, and I was still, young, and I started thinking, well, maybe I wasn't an alcoholic. I was verbalizing this. I said, maybe I was just young. I mean, young people can drink responsibly. What young person has a glass of Chardonnay? You know, young people don't do that. All young people drink to get drunk. And she said, well, why don't you go out there and try it? And I got terrified. I was like, no, I don't want to do that. God puts these people in my life to say the right things. You know, those are the little seeds, you know. Not all my faith comes from big revelations like that, you know. They're little things. When I was brandy new, riding on the school bus in school and wondering how was I going to not drink that day at school, and a car would drive by and say, live and let live. First things first. You know, the coincidence is maybe, I don't think so. There's been so many coincidences in my life, you know. And there was a time in my sobriety where I would sit and meet. Oh, Bob just blew my face. I would sit in meetings and judge people. You know, I don't know if we've all done it, but I did. And I don't want to go to that meeting; they're awful. Yeah. And someone said to me, "Sarah, who are you to choose who God speaks through?" And I was like, "Okay, point taken." You know, even whether somebody walks it or not, if I hear it, that's what I need to hear today. You know, and I mean, for me, a lot of my faith comes with acceptance. You know, life's not always been easy. You know, I did end up quitting high school because I just didn't think I was going to make it sobriety-wise there. Moved to New Jersey, started working. Then I went back to school. Then I got married. Then I moved. Had to stop going to school because I was away from the college. You know, a lot of things happened. I have a very compulsive personality. And I had three kids in 4 years, all planned. And people used to say, don't you have a TV? I'm like, well, yeah. But, you know, and they're now 18, 19, and 20. But those are gifts of these, but it's not been without challenges, you know. And I found, you know, when I moved to New Jersey, I was chasing a man, boy, kid, whatever. And that didn't work out, and it took a long time, but I was able to find in here, through working these steps, working with people, going on retreats, a couple of retreat members here with me, I'm like psyched to see everybody, and just being honest and looking at life on life's terms, I've been able to love me for me and stopped attracting people who weren't for me. You know, a lot of that was based on my opinion of myself. And my opinion of myself, I think somebody else said it, was based on what you all thought of me. It wasn't based on what I saw in the mirror, because what I saw in the mirror was nothing. You know, I was ugly. I was, you know, I had a really bad, you know, I had eating issues. So I thought I was fat. I was thin. I was this. I was that. You know, I just didn't like what I saw in the mirror. I didn't think I was worthy. I had that whole thing that you were all going to find out about me and get found out. I'm not a real grown-up. You know, I still think that sometimes. But, you know, when people call me ma'am, I'm like, really? I forget that I am not, you know, like, coming around so long and so young in the rooms, I forget that I am not, I am an adult now, you know? I forget that. Like, oh, my God. But my faith, you know, it was able to attract me to a wonderful, wonderful man that I married in these rooms. And it brought me to his family, which is, just amazing, because my family, I don't have a birth family much anymore. But I have my husband's family. I have all of you. And it's just an amazing gift, you know, to have that. It's just beyond my wildest dreams, you know. My kids are my family, and I'm able to be there for them. There was a time, because I hear a lot of people, you know, real involved in service, and I haven't been as involved as I'd like to be. I'm starting to get more involved again. But with that many kids in that short of time, yeah, and I had a wonderful sponsor who used to take me by the hand, and she'd say, there, dear, it's okay. You're sponsoring your kids right now. You can come into meetings, do what you need to do, and then you'll get back out there. And that's what's happening, you know. I picked up a new sponsor a few years ago, and we went through the steps through the big book. You know, back in the day when I first came in, we would, like, read the step book at a step meeting once a week, and we'd kind of discuss the step, and that was that. You know, it was really awesome going through the big book, doing the work, you know. That was awesome. It's awesome doing that with other people, you know. It's just, you can't give what you don't got, you know. And by doing it, and by doing it with other people, it's like I'm doing it again, you know. I had a thing came to my head, and I don't know if I'll remember it correctly, but, you know, we've all heard about the onion, you know, the layers of the onion, and it keeps unraveling. But here's the thing. When you're peeling that onion, there's a lot of tears, you know. But then when you cook it up, it gets all sweet, you know. And that's how my life really has turned, you know. In 2008, my faith was tested, huge. I was diagnosed with cancer. And I was not alone going through it, you know. That's the huge, amazing thing, you know. I had all of you. I mean, I had, you know, neighbors brought meals, but you guys were the people that were calling me to say, how are you? They didn't want me to be positive all the time. You know, you guys. You didn't want me to be positive. You wanted to hear how I really was. You know, my neighbors saying, oh, cheer up, dang, you're here. And it, yeah, okay. You know, I was, because we've all faced our own mortality before, you know, and here I was doing it again in sobriety, but you all got it, you know. Because it is, it's a thing, you know, when you're faced with it, it is what it is. And we've all been there, you know. So it was just such a gift, you know, that I had all of you there. And I always knew when I couldn't get to meetings, you came to me, you know. You always had that faith in me. And, you know, and yeah, I had to take medication. You were there watching me, you know, taking care of me when I couldn't take care of myself. That was huge. And it never at any point did I say, oh, my God, I'm going to die. Because it was whatever was meant to be, you know? And that's why it's such a relief to be not in control. It really is. I was thinking yesterday, it's Independence Day. And it's really cool, you know, I'm speaking on Independence Day. Because I'm independent from alcohol, but yet I'm dependent on God. It's that paradox, you know, that makes life so much easier for me. My kids, like I said, are 18, 19, and 20. And they're not abstinent. they're not in the honor society. They did not graduate high school 4.0s. You know, I don't know. I don't know. Time will tell. They didn't crash and burn like me and my husband, that's for sure. But that being said, there was a time where I went into a panic phase, especially with my daughter, because girls are a lot more vulnerable. I know where we could end up. I've been in a lot, you know. Anyway, I was projecting a lot of myself on her. And I found myself panicking and checking the, you know, track your iPhone app and tracking her all over town. And I was sent to Al-Anon. I don't go regularly. I love you people. I don't go regularly enough. However, it's not my concern, you know. My prayers every day. And I know my husband mentioned it when he spoke yesterday, and it's so true. I don't know how we started doing this, but we, every morning, we pray together. We kneel at the bed, and we read from our little book, and then we just are silent together. And it's an amazing thing that we're able to do that. And that's one of the things I ask for every day is, God, please help my babies to make good decisions and keep them safe. And that's all I can do, you know. And that's what I ask for myself today. I say, God, please help me to make good decisions today and please help me to do your will. I don't say keep me healthy because I don't know what his will is for me. I don't say to keep my friends and loved ones healthy. I just say, please give me acceptance for whatever you have in store for me. I was talking to somebody before the meeting, and the type of cancer I had has a high risk of recurrence. I mean, I'm approaching 7 years, so I'm probably in the clear, but you know, you don't know. And the way I came to accept that, and not because I lived in the fear for a little while, and I just couldn't live that way anymore. You know, living it's okay to have fear. You know, that's one of the things I learned in these rooms is that I can have all the feelings in the world. You know, there's, you know, anger is something I can't afford, yada, yada. I got to feel my emotions. Resentment I can't afford. But anger I can have. Fear I can have. I just can't live in it. I can't let it own me. And the way I do that is I do acceptance. You know, I pray for acceptance. And what I did is I accepted that, yeah, I could die from cancer. And it could come back. So you know what? If it's going to do that, I might as well live each day today instead of wasting it worrying. And I went back to school and I got a degree. I'm going back in the fall to get another degree. And you know what? That's because I have faith. I had so much fear. When I remember when I first stepped foot in school, I was like, oh my God, these are not my people. You know, because I can do this. I mean, I was petrified, but now the fear's gone, you know, standing up here. I'm just in awe of all of you and just so grateful for the opportunity. But, you know, those were other people. They're going to judge me, you know. And then I realized, you know, they're just acceptance, you know. They're going to accept me. I got to accept me. And once I accepted me, it doesn't matter anymore. It's about keeping my side of the street clean, doing the next right thing, you know, and looking in the mirror the end of the day. And the way what I can look in the mirror at the end of the day isn't what you can look in the mirror at the end of the day, you know. And I used to, even in recovery, compare people's recoveries with mine. I can't do that either, you know. I know if I'm honest when I look in that mirror and keeping the faith and doing the next right thing. And that's the thing I cling to the most is you know, when they said seeds of faith, I, you know, like I said, I started trying to plan it out and, oh, maybe I should take some notes or read this, read that. Seeds. When was seed planted? Mustard seed, you know, and the mustard seed is, it's the tiniest little seed, but it grows into this huge tree or bush. I've never seen a mustard plant, but that's what I've read. but I'll tell you what, it's got a really strong flavor, so we'll go with it. But really, the little seeds were planted from when I was 13 years old and walked in these rooms, you know. And I heard, that was the thing that was constant all the way through, you know, the steps. And the steps are all God-based. And I didn't have a concept of God, you know. But I had you, you know, and good orderly direction and just good. And you know what? I was able to fake it. And I still don't have a concept of God because I am just little me. I can't comprehend, you know, what's out there. And I don't need to. I don't even want to figure it out anymore. There's the acceptance again. I don't even care. I don't want to figure it out. I just believe. And that's what keeps me together and sane today. You know, and like I said, life happens. But that's what keeps me focused and sane. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That was really great. You did get a couple of bonus minutes there because I forgot to put my stopwatch on. And then when you took your shawl off, I got kind of scared here, you know. Whoa. Our next speaker is from North Dakota, and he actually, Don, I can say his name now because he's passed away, Nicholson, from North Dakota. I know there's a couple of people here that he sponsored and had 50-some years before he passed away that was a great AA, and I had met him, and he spoke in Saskatoon and Prince Albert in Saskatchewan, and just a great person. As we all remembered him, it was by, that he owned the Kentucky Fried Chicken in Fargo. Anyway, here's Lee from Fargo.
Hi, my name's Lee, and I'm an alcoholic from Fargo, North Dakota. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September 25th, 1993, and for that I am grateful. I'm the baby of this group. You know, and it sounds like when John was sharing there that, I don't know, it's like You were sending your sponsor over to see me because that's kind of the sponsorship I had. You know, and you, boy, you brought back some old memories with As a Man Thinketh and with Emmett Fox. Those are some dandy, some good stuff. You know, our operator's manual, like all the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our operator's manual, it tells us to seek out other, you know, outside information. And I'm a firm believer in that, you know, and I don't know why I'm kind of nervous. And that's okay. It sounds like my comfort zone's going to get a little stretched here today. Because she mentioned sea of love. That's what I see out here is a sea of love here. You people want me to do well, you know. I must have something that somebody, you know, I can help somebody out. Because years ago, when I was sitting in a treatment center, somebody like me or somebody like you came up and shared their story when I was sitting in treatment. And trust me, radar, Alcoholics Anonymous was not on my radar screen. You were not on my radar screen. If somebody had asked me about Alcoholics Anonymous, it was probably a bunch of winos down in the basement of the Salvation Army. You know, a bunch of emotional cripples. You know, and what I found out here after being here for a while is the only difference between what I thought was that and what I really, you know, what really is a lot of yets. You know, you're eligible too. But anyway, yeah, there were so many things that I, you know, this seeds of faith, the things, what I wanted to share with you is I earned this seat here. I don't need to go into a lot of stuff about how I got here. I know one thing, I got the gift of desperation. I told you my sobriety date was September 25th. On September 24th, 1993, I was just driving home minding my own business and I rear-ended a federal probation officer at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And here I was, a hip, slick, cool business owner. You know, how could this happen to me? Hi-ho, hi-ho, off to jail I go. See, I'd been there when I was 18 years old. I'd been in jail before. You know, and it flooded me with all those old feelings. And, you know, as I started getting into this program, I'm gonna bounce around here a little bit, but it was described to me, you know, like in the second step, in restore me to sanity. And how is this when I first got here? I'm not insane. What's the definition of insane? Well, when it feels like you should swallow the end of a 12-gauge shotgun, is that normal thinking? See, when you're in that picture, everything seems like it should be in that picture, but you get outside that picture and look back in it after you've had the chance for the fog to clear, you know, you're going, boy, a lot of this stuff just is plain crazy, you know, and you know, alcohol had a huge influence in my life. I found it when I was 11 or 12 years old. And it became my solution. And I used that solution for many, many years. I was 45 years old when I found you people. I spent 4 years in the Marine Corps. You think surrender was in my vocabulary? I don't really think so. It was seek out, engage with, and destroy the enemy. But that night after I got that DUI and got to jail again. Got home and my wife was out of town and I called a neighbor up and I tried to drink all that pain away. It couldn't go away. The magic was gone. And it did it all the next day. And I remember sitting there that night the next day and I went over to my neighbor's place. He could tell I was really in a bad spot. Because he says, come on over, we better have a drink. Alcohol saved my life because there was no, instead of swallowing a 12-gauge shotgun. And that night, I remember sitting there looking at this half a drink, and it was like, you know, if something doesn't change, nothing's going to change. And I did not have G-O-D in my life, but I had a gift of desperation. I didn't understand that. You know, I was desperate enough to reach out for some help. And that's when I was more of an agnostic than anything. I had a good Lutheran background bringing up. But I had no connection. There was no connection to that G-O-D. you know. And I've heard my story so many times in these rooms here that the similarities are so much alike. But my path, how I got here was, to this thing was a process. It's a process like when you get to the 12th step, it says, as a result of taking these steps. Well, I was so new and in treatment, and this guy comes up, I'm insane. This guy comes up while I'm in treatment, and he shares his story. See, I thought an alcoholic was some bum that lived underneath, like I told you, some bum that lived underneath the bridge, his butt was hanging out of his pants, you know. That wasn't me. God, I had all this stuff. I was supposedly successful. But when he shared his story, I found a lot of similarities in there. He had been to the mountaintop, and he drank it all away. And he looked as ordinary as I did. And he says, you know, there's a lot of ways to get sober. But I'm here on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous. He just made it that simple. Just that simple. And that was enough to put that chink in my armor, as they talk about. And then they started suggesting that I go to meetings. And by the way, my home group is the Saturday morning men's group. Meets every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. I'm sponsored. And I feel like I'm in Mecca in Fargo because it's Fargo-Moorhead. And we have a strong inner group. We got young people that are just on fire. And so I have many groups that I go to. But getting back to where I was starting is I started going to this group. And matter of fact, there's a gentleman sitting down on the floor down there when I went to that first meeting of my home group. Now, he was there. They started talking, because I was having a struggle with GOD, and he was the one that said, you know, we're just a group of drunks, GOD, looking for some good orderly direction. She had mentioned GOD, you know. And during the process of doing all this, this had gone to the fourth and fifth step. I had done a kind of a quasi one, hadn't really gone through it. Taken through a sponsor. Well, one thing that did came up was this resentments. And along with that resentments was there was people that you harmed. And this is one of the things I wanted to share with you is that there was, I have to give you a little background. I grew up in this little town called Two Harbors, Minnesota, on the north shore of Lake Superior. There was 10 people on my dad's side of the family, and I had there's one uncle left. He is like a second surrogate father to me since my father passed away. But there was another, his brother or my uncle. He was a colorful man. He was a colorful guy. When I grew up, he was living with us, you know, and he, he liked to drink, and I was an only child, and he was a deputy sheriff at one time. My godfather was Lake County sheriff. And he worked for him. And back in those days, it used to be those little 3-2 joints up and down the way. And I'd tag along with him, and it was like Disneyland. It was Disneyland for a guy like me. I loved it, you know. So I was getting that vicarious enjoyment out of that. But anyway, along the way, we did a lot of different things. He'd let me do a lot of things. Well, let's fast forward to him about 19 years old, and I'm having issues. And one night I'm drunk, and I needed some money, and I went up to borrow some money from him. And there was a guy living with him, and come up there, and both of them had passed out. They'd been partying all day long. Well, I stole the guy's wallet that was living with him. Took his money. The thing was, that guy called the sheriff on my uncle, which was, you know, my uncle used to work for him. And it was very embarrassing for him. And, so nobody, I'd never shared that with anybody. I had never told a soul. But every time I'd go back home, because I was living in Fargo at that time, getting out of the Marine Corps, and the ick was here. I'd get back and I'd see him, and that would come up. I knew I'd heard him. See, that was one of those things that was that load I was carrying among many things. Well, anyway, I knew
I had to make amends to him. And I was about 5 or 6 months sober. And I made a decision. I was talking to the guys, and I said, I've got to go up and do this. And I did. I made an appointment with him, and he had since moved into town, and he was kind of a horse trader, sold a little of this and that, whatever. And I went into his garage on a Saturday morning, and we were alone, and I brought up the subject about that, and he remembered it like it was yesterday. And he was a pretty volatile man, too, at times, you know, and we had done a lot of fun things together. I was kind of an apple in his eye. I was an only kid, and living with me, and, you know, us, and it was extremely awkward, and I was full of fear, but I had prayed before I got there. I was told to pray before I got there. And I didn't know what the results were going to be. And about that time, out of nowhere, a guy comes walking into his garage and wanted to buy something from him. Today, I truly believe my HP sent that guy there. Well, anyway, after that guy left, I went over to my uncle and I says, you know, I caused all that problem. I'm really sorry for that. I hope you can forgive me someday. And he had processed it too well in that time. And he looked me right in the eye, and he says, you know, what's between us is between us. Now, I had heard about this third step prayer. I had read a little bit about the third step prayer. When I walked out of his garage, I literally experienced in my heart, feeling the release of bondage of self. You can't buy that experience. You can't buy any of this, but you can experience it. That was just one. I was 5 months sober. I was beginning on my journey, and this is still a journey for me, but it was the journey. It had gone, it planted one of those, as they say, the seeds of faith. It gave me faith that I was on the right path, because I liked the results of what happened after I was willing to take the action. Because even like our speaker last night, do the deal. Do the deal. And that was just the beginning of that. Let's fast forward 6 years past that time. I was telling you about another uncle of mine that's still living. Well, this other uncle that I had made amends with was having a lot of health issues. And he was the type of guy that nobody could tell him anything. And anyway, this other one asked me to come and help him because they had tried to get a directive so he could be his power of attorney. And he told everybody to stick it where the sun doesn't shine. And he had problems, but, you know, he'd be lucid sometimes. Sometimes he wasn't. When he was okay, he didn't think he needed any help. It's one of those things, you know. So anyway, I went up there and I got the paperwork, and I walked in there the day before, and I says, "Unc, you know, your brother, my other uncle, needs some help. He wants to help you because you need help." And I didn't know where it was going. I says, "I just went through it," and I says, "We're going to be back tomorrow," you know. And when I showed up the next day, and they had the magistrate, and they had done this dance before, you know. So I sat down on the bed with them, and I said a prayer before I went in there, and I didn't have any idea what the results were going to be. And I put my arm around him, and I says, "We went through it page by page, and he agreed on everything, and he thought that was just fine. He signed the papers, he signed everything he needed to sign, and they walked out of the room. People there just shook their head; they couldn't believe what happened." I'll tell you what I did. I wrapped my arms around him, and I cried. You people gave me that gift, you know. All that did was it galvanized me resolve about this in this program. See, just like in our step book, you know, the St. Francis prayer, make me a channel. All of a sudden, that prayer became real. I mean, really real. I got to be a channel. You know, I get to experience a lot of those things in today. And actually, I feel more, my good friend sitting down there, I feel more comfortable going to, we go to jail every other week. We always say we go to jail so we don't go to jail. He's nicknamed us the Sunshine Boys. Because we tell him we're not here to blow sunshine up your ass. But we can tell you about, we both of us got out of a living hell that we were in, and we can share our experience, strength, and hope. You know, when our payday comes, when someday comes, somebody comes up and taps you on the shoulder and you say, "Remember me?" I'm sure there's many people that have been involved with service that have had that experience. See, there again, it's just doing the legwork of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this just humbles me. It just humbles me to be able to come here and to be able to share some, just that's, I'm just giving you little bits of snippets and stuff. There's guys over in that wall there that I've been involved in service with, work for many, many years. You know, been involved with West Central Regional Service Conferences, state roundups, you know, and all you have to do is ask for help. One thing I found out, I cannot do this by myself. I tried it, you know. What I discovered along this journey, and it was very early on, is that because it talks about self-diagnosis, you know, and I, with all the evidence being presented to me, and what it was shown to me, is that I have an illness called alcoholism. See, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Alcoholic was such a what a label, isn't that? What's a label? You know, you know what I told you what I thought an alcoholic was. This label of alcoholic. So really, I kind of backdoored myself into this thing. Is that, you know, all the evidence is here that I have an illness called alcoholism. Guess what? You must be an alcoholic, sport. And you know, and for whatever reason, it just all of a sudden I felt comfortable with that, and I still have to this day. You know, the thing is with this illness, I've witnessed it take many people's lives over the years. I've seen people come and go, you know, and if you've been around, I don't have them singing to the choir about that. So what I found through the program Alcoholics Anonymous is that, and you people, is you're my medicine. You're my medicine for my illness of alcoholism. And so it's like the prescription, the doctor's prescription, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to fill that prescription on a regular basis. If I don't get the medicine, I'll succumb to the illness. I want to come to meetings to get those reports, because the reports, it never ceases to get the reports. I'm happy for the ones that come back to give the report, because there's many that don't, you know. I've never, in all the years that I've been around, and I'm sure the panel is sitting up here, I've never heard anybody to come back to a meeting and say, I just wanted to tell you I had so damn much fun out there drinking. I just wanted to tell you and come back to report to you that it was just wonderful out there. No. I've seen it where they've come back really wounded and a butt full of arrows. You know? But even as slowly as they pluck those arrows out and get healed up, how many times do you see what they get well coming here, going to meetings and doing this and that and whatever? And all of a sudden, life gets in the way, you know. But I just know that by working these steps, and especially, you know, I have learned more by sponsoring other guys about myself than I could ever give them, ever. And if you haven't sponsored anybody, do it. Because, you know, the operators, you don't have to, you know, I tell people, you don't have to figure this out. Just follow the instructions. See, and I get to go through and when I'm working with somebody else, I get to follow the instructions again and again. And then I discover some things about myself. I'm not Mr. Wonderful. And I'm not perfect. I suffer from perfectionism, though. No? God, that's... How are we doing here?
1 minute.
1 minute. Well, anyway, God's grace is in my life, and I feel very fortunate, you know. And I got people like you that surround me. I have a network of friends that I, you know, when I work with people, I say, develop your own network of friends. Plug into them, you know. And that's what I did. And it's because of you people in this program that I'm enjoying this gift of sobriety. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Lee. Now, I'm supposed to just say a little bit about my story. We don't have a lot of time left, but I came into the program 1978, just before Christmas. You'd think a guy could wait till after New Year's, right? But the thing was, I spent a year before coming into the program. My wife, who is sitting right here, that has one more year of sobriety than I do, and I came home pretty hammered, and she was so drunk she couldn't talk. And I told her she had to do something about her drinking. Another seed was planted. Anyway, she, I guess, obviously took it to heart, and 4 days later she told me that she'd gone to an AA meeting and she was going to, and she liked what she heard and she was going to try that. Well, geez, you don't have to go that far. Like, put less ice in, more mix, and I give her all the answers, right? Anyway, to make a long story short, that year that I tried to prove I wasn't an alcoholic was the hardest year I ever had in my life. And I had her going to the lake. I had her going different places. It was all premeditated drunks on my part that I know now. But I guess my professional career as a hockey player, my whole life was around winning and losing. Everything was based around winning and losing. And I played cards. I hated to lose. And you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was beat, and I was losing my business that I had started, and I was a mess. And I was a loser. And going to AA, I really thought I was a loser. And you know what? You've got to be a loser. When I played for the Montreal Canadiens and we won the Stanley Cup, world champions, we didn't win all the games. We had to lose in order to become a better winner. And so, Alcoholics Anonymous, when I came, I felt like I was a real loser. And you know what? I became one of the most winning things that I've ever done in my life. I have God as my general manager. AA is a great team. And I have to look at it my way because that's just the way it is. But I'm on AA's team now. And I have God as my general manager. It's pretty simple. And I have a coach who's my sponsor. And I have teammates all over the world. Boy, sitting in that stadium last night, how powerful. To be in a sports arena and every one of us was playing our part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Fantastic. I would I'd just like to say that 51 years of marriage, I think that's pretty neat. And I have some friends over here that I was sitting with last night at the meeting. It was fantastic. From actually, they live next door to the guy that was the trainer for the New York Rangers when I was there. How small a world is that? Sitting there in that 56 or 60,000 people. Damon's here from my home group in Floral, Saskatchewan. And it's good to see him. And all the other people that I've met that are here, fantastic. One more hand for our speakers. I think they were just absolutely fantastic.